Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Oh, hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and we are sponsored by two great sponsors. The first one is the Stumptown Improv Festival, and it's happening this summer in Portland, Oregon. And here's a fun fact. Summer in Portland, Oregon is literally perfect. So if you enjoy top drawer comedy and perfection, then get to the Stumptown Improv Festival in Portland, Oregon. It's happening from August 13th through the 15th at the Milagro Theater. Submissions are open until May 15th, so you don't have much time. More information, all you have to do is go to their Facebook page and their website, which is StumptownImprov.com. That's StumptownImprov.com, where you can check out pics from the 2014 festival. We're also sponsored by the Institution Theater Summer Lockup. Now, Austin is not only a great city to visit, but it's the home to a thriving improv scene. And one of the cornerstones to that is the Institution Theater, who is inviting everyone to join them for a unique improv intensive. It's 5 days of personalized diagnostics designed to help you find and strengthen your voice as an improviser. Led by Tom Booker and Asa Vronin, who have over 50 years' experience between them and their experienced staff, the influences range from the Annoyance Theater and Second City to Viewpoints and even stand-up. Along the way, there'll also be performance, social, and entertainment opportunities throughout beautiful Austin, Texas. It's happening July 6th through July 10th for only $350. Register before May 22nd, and it's only $300. Go to theinstitutiontheater.com. That's theinstitutiontheater.com to register. And if you're in Chicago this July, check out my Artist Low Comedy Intensive offered on two separate weekends. All you have to do for more information is go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. We have another great episode for you today, but when do we not have a great episode for you today? Can you think back when we didn't have a good episode for you? And this one concludes our three episodes that we filmed for the New York Improv Festival at the People's Improv Theater. And what a way to end it. Our guest today is none other than Ali Farinakian, and he is the founder of the People's Improv Theater, or as they say in the know, PIT. Now, before that, he studied with Del Close and Charna Halpern at the I.O. Chicago. That's back in the 90s. That's where I first met him. And he was part of the legendary Harold team, The Family. He was also a founding member of the UCB. He's wrote for Saturday Night Live. He's got tons of TV and film credits, so just go on IMDb and check that out. We talked to him about when he first came to Chicago and he wanted to be a writer and how he ended up on stage performing and improvising. We talked to him about leaving the UCB to start the PIT and what it takes to run a successful theater. Again, I want to thank Ali and Ronnie Pascal for inviting me out, not only to do three improv nerds at their wonderful theater, but also to teach my Art of Slow Comedy workshop. And they treated me like a rock star, and the theater couldn't have been so welcoming, and just it's a really cool space. So if you're in New York, check out the Pitt Theater. But before we get to the interview with Ali, I just want to say that I haven't talked about this in a while. I think I'm in fear with it and denial. But Lauren and I, my wife, we're still trying to have a baby, and we've done like four or five fertility treatments, and they have not taken. And yesterday we went to the fertility doctor, and I got in a fight with him because I'm very frustrated with this process. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of emotional energy. It takes a lot of money. And so now they want to do a more invasive, a more intense procedure to see if we can get Lauren pregnant. And it scares me. Lauren keeps saying, oh, do you want to have a kid? And I kind of are like, well, why don't we have a kid? And then let me decide if I want to have a kid. I don't know if I want to have a kid because I'm scared. And and then the thing that I'm most afraid of is they're going to put her on hormones. And when she's on hormones, she's very emotional. And I have a hard time with not taking it personally. And it's just, you know, it's a roller coaster. So I just wanted to give you an update on that. It doesn't surprise you that I'm afraid and have a lot of ambivalence about being a father, but in some respects, I think we're getting closer. And I talked to my friend because I felt a lot of shame about. I was really upset. I was really angry at the doctor, and one of my friends said, well, you're getting closer to having a baby and some feelings are coming out. So I'm not good with feelings, as you know. You are going to love this episode with Ali Farinacci, and it goes a little long, and I always feel a little shame afterwards, you know, with the guests because, you know, I went over an hour or something. There is so much in here, and he's so honest and so candid about everything that you are just going to love it. Here it is, the Ali Farinacci episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate this. I'm a little intimidated by you because you have such a strong presence in life and on stage. So I just want to say I'm just a little nervous.
Thank you.
I have a little fear. Can I just turn that over? How are you feeling?
Good. Yeah. I mean, you know, elephant in the room. We're probably all nervous except for the people in the audience.
Right. And I don't know what to expect, because you are a master of bits. You are a master of bits.
I love me some bits.
You know. And
aside from the bar that I own called All Bits Aside, where you're not allowed to do any bits in All Bits Aside.
But they closed real quickly, didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, closed pretty quickly.
Okay. So you were born in Iran, and you grew up mainly in North Carolina. And your dad was a doctor, and you wanted to be a doctor. So when you told them that you're going to go into comedy, how did they react?
Well, I don't know if I told them I was going to go into comedy.
Did you lie?
No, I didn't lie. I just, after Carolina, you know, I realized that I wasn't going to become a doctor. Probably my sophomore year, I was watching an episode of St. Elsewhere. No, my freshman year, with Denzel Washington playing Philip Chandler. And I was watching this episode in my room at Carolina. And after the end of the episode, I started crying. I was like, I will never be a doctor. And it hit me. I just didn't have the, you know, whether it's the intelligence or the stamina to get through organic chemistry. I was just impatient. I like the idea of being a doctor, but I don't think I could have become a doctor, although I've been doctors on TV. So then, after that, I eventually went to Chicago after Carolina ended and began doing.
And here's something that I didn't realize when I was doing the research, that you actually were Iranian.
Yeah,
you are still. Ass, yeah.
And that hasn't changed.
But the thing I find interesting is it never was part of your comedy. Did you feel that you had to downplay your nationality?
No, I mean, I grew up in, you know, Connecticut, North Carolina, you know, and so to me it was never anything that I thought of until the hostage crisis when I was a seventh grader, and then I became very aware of it.
Did kids make fun of you?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like in what way?
Well, I remember, you know, like one time I was getting on the bus to go and play, I think it was soccer for my school, and all of a sudden a large group of kids began to erupt in a chant of, send the Klan to Iran, send the Klan to Iran. It's like, oh, jeez. So I got in the back of the bus. In my mind, that's when I was like, you know, send the fucking Klan to Iran. You'll see what happens. We'll gun them down. Send the Klan to Iran. Yeah, send them all. Send every one of them, you know. But then I got in the back of the bus, and this guy came up to me. His name was Ken Makovic. And his uncle was, I think at that time, the head coach of the Atlanta Falcons. And he came up to me and he said, look, he was like a senior, I believe. He said, look, if anybody gives you any grief anymore, you come to me. I got your back. I was like, really? He was like, yeah. I was like, wow. So that had to happen, that event, to have a guy like that to do that, to realize that I would want to be that kind of guy for other people later. But later in life, it was a lot like Quantum Leap. Like, I didn't realize, like, I look like this because I grew up, you know.
And then what did you grow up? It was very white. Danbury, Connecticut
Yeah, population 150, you know, small country town, you know. We had motorcycles by age 8, shooting bows and arrows and chasing Sasquatch. You know, that was kind of the life there. And then when I was a sixth grader, we moved to a place called Bermuda Run, which was, you know, my dad saw this ad in a newspaper when we were visiting Iran with my mother and sister that said gated community. What is this gated community? And next thing you know, he bought this house while we were gone. And it was on the first hole of a golf course, which we still live there. They still live there. So, yeah, I always thought of myself as just like, you know, a suburban kid.
Is that the when you were in the guy who was taking care of you in the back of the bus, is that where you got, because I've been around the pit the last day or two, there's this sense of like, and even in Chicago, at Second City or Iowa, fighting for the little guy. Was that where do you think it came from?
Yeah, I think that time in my life, those 444 days, were definitely a crucible that defined, you know, who I was going to be. I might have been a bully if it weren't for that period of time, if that had happened, you know. Because Iran was definitely on the way, at that point, to becoming one of the cool ethnicities. Like, you know, Irish or Italian, you know. I remember going to Washington, D.C. on a class trip in, like, third grade. We sold light bulbs to go to Washington, D.C. That's a different story. But and we were taking a tour around D.C., and the bus driver said, and on your right is the Iranian embassy, considered by many to be the most beautiful embassies in Washington, D.C. And everyone was like, Ali's from Iran. I mean, back then it was really just black, white, and then it was, I was one brown dude. The Hispanics hadn't even arrived at that point. You know, on any level, where I was growing up.
So you watched Saturday Night Live growing up, and you said John Belushi was a big influence because...
Well, because he looked kind of like me. I mean, he was, like, darker. He had curly black hair. He was of a certain size. And, you know, I watched the show from the very beginning. And in North Carolina, all of a sudden you see somebody on this light box. It's like, oh. I mean, it never made me think that I could do this or I wanted to do it. That epiphany didn't happen until Christmas Eve of 89, but I always loved comedy.
And what happened at Christmas Eve of 89?
It was my fifth year at Carolina. I was about to graduate. As I said, I thought I wanted to be a doctor. I went to Carolina to get a JD, MD, MBA, PhD in pharmacology. Five years later, I settled for a BA in psych. And I was watching SNL as I'd always done at home for Christmas Eve, and all of a sudden I had this legitimate epiphany of I want to write for this show at some point in my life. After the show, I went upstairs.
You wanted to write. You didn't want to perform.
I didn't have the courage to say that yet. Mm-hmm. And even when I went to Chicago, I didn't go there to be a performer. I went there to take Michael McCarthy's sketchwriting class at Second City. So even then, I had not said the words, I want to get up on stage.
How do you end up in Chicago? You make a 411 phone call?
Yeah, basically, after that epiphany, I went back to Carolina. I told some friends about the epiphany.
But you were a funny guy, right, up to this point?
Yeah, I mean, come on. Right.
you would go to different rooms of the fraternity. You were a frat guy, which surprised me.
Right, but it was the kind of fraternity, Chi Psi at Carolina was the kind of fraternity for guys who didn't want to be in a fraternity. You know?
So it was like an anti-fraternity.
Yeah, but all cool guys, very funny guys, and I would just go from room to room doing bits while they were studying. I was like the study break, you know, going from room to room. And the first time I ever performed, I was looking at some photos, was back then in 89, where I hosted this thing called Coffee House, which was like a basically a talent show. But after the epiphany, I told a friend of mine about the epiphany, and he said, well, you should look into this place called Second City in Chicago. We used to go there on class trips. So I used the Google of the time, 411. I called Chicago, hello, Second City, hello. Do you have any writing classes? I talked to this guy named Joffrey. And for anybody who remembered Second City, he ran the training center at that time. He said, yeah, I've got a great writing class starting November 1st with Michael McCarthy, former SNL writer. I said, sign me up. And then that began the process.
But before that, when did you write the letter to Lorne Michaels?
Well, after I... After the epiphany, I went up to my room and I put together what I look back on later as a running order for the show.
For Saturday Night Live.
I mean, I watched every episode, you know, since the beginning, except for when I was in college. And those Saturday nights, I was probably out partying and not probably watching it. But I knew what it was, you know. And then I wrote a couple of sketches. And then I remember I wrote a very heartfelt letter to Lorne. And at one point during our fraternity initiation, someone came and got me and said... hey, SNL just called. I said, what? And I was, at this point, probably doing some type of psilocybin of some kind. I don't know. And I said, are you messing with me? He goes, no. They said they'd call back in 30 minutes. I said, okay. And so I was upstairs in the initiation process of the fraternity. And then all of a sudden, they said, yeah, someone's on the phone for you. And I ran downstairs, and I got on the fraternity phone.
What are you thinking at this point?
I'm thinking, this is a joke. It's a bit. Someone's doing a prank. I get on the phone, and I'm like, hello? Hi, this is Cindy. Her name was Cindy Nathanson. She used to work at SNL. She goes, hi, Lorne got your letter. He was very impressed by it. He wanted me to call you and just chat with you about it. I was like, oh, okay. I was like, what can I do? He's like, well, why don't you send us two sketches and we'll go from there. I was like, any advice? Yeah, put up your stuff anywhere you can. Keep writing and, you know, just put up your writing.
What did you write in that letter that got to Lorne Michaels?
I think it was just a very heartfelt, very short letter. Just talked about how I'd watched the show since the beginning. I love, you know, The Art of Sketch Comedy. You know, I don't even have it. It's probably on some hard drive of an old computer. But basically, how do I write for the show? And he had somebody call me.
Did you send those sketches in?
I sent the sketches in. And then I called, I remember on like, I guess I didn't even know the timeline, but when I was calling, it was the last week of the show, and I got someone on the phone, and I said, yeah, I'm just calling to check about some sketches I sent to Cindy, and they go, oh, this is Cindy's last week at the show, she's leaving. I was like, oh, okay, and then they got her on the phone, and I said, like, hi, Cindy, this is Ali, I heard you're moving on, and she goes, where'd you hear that? And I was like, oh, someone just told me on the phone. She goes, yeah. I said, well, I'm just checking on the sketches. She goes, yeah, I'll put them on the, you know, I'll make sure they get in on the pile. So I guess at that point, looking back now, I realize they just ended up on a pile of sketches. And again, they weren't ready. I mean, they weren't, you know, they were okay, but it was nothing remotely that should have got anybody hired. I think it was Chris Farley as a dating game chaperone. You know, it was, I remember when the dating game happened and you had someone would go as your chaperone. It was, what if Farley was your dating game chaperone? That was one of the sketches, you know, and I can't remember the other one.
So you end up in Chicago and you take Michael McCarthy's class.
Mm-hmm.
But do you take classes at Second City?
No, I mean, again, I'm still, you know, just the naivete of it. I went there and took one class a week, you know, and really wasn't doing the Second City thing for the other classes, the improv classes. I found out about Improv Olympic. I read an article about Dell in GQ where they did a makeover for the cast of Gods Must Be Lazy. And I saw him and I'd heard about him and read that article. And then I went to see something. I started going seeing Improv Olympic shows. I mean, I guess I went to Papa Milano's and I saw those shows.
When it was in the basement there.
Right. And then I went to see something at Second City on the main stage, the Southern Comfort Comedy Challenge. And it was the main stage of Second City. And I saw
Blue Velveeta,
mm-hmm. Dorf, and
Jay Leggett,
Mitch Rouse, yeah.
Tom Booker, Susan Messing,
yeah.
Brendan Sullivan,
uh-huh.
Brian Blundell,
mm-hmm. and Brian Stack. He was playing with them. And I was like, well, when I first went to Second City, Second City had this great thing where you could see shows for free if you were taking classes back then. So I went to, as soon as I got there, I went and saw the main stage show, and you could see the sets every night. And the lights came up the first time, and I saw Pasquazi and O'Malley in a blackout.
Dave Pasquazi, Tim O'Malley.
Yeah, and it was flag smoking permitted in lobby only. And at that point, I was like, what is this? Wow. And I guess at that point, you know, it was starting to, like, the idea of performing started happening.
So that was the first time you're like, you'd come to Chicago, you just wanted to be a writer at this
point. That's what I told myself.
Okay. So then you get into classes at IO.
Well, then I go see the Southern Comfort Comedy Challenge. She started that night.
Sharna Halpern.
I say, hey, I'm interested in taking your class. She's like, give me a call. And the classes back then were like $150. But if you referred someone, you got $50 off. So I signed up for the class. There was another friend of mine, Giovanni, who was in my sketch writing class with Michael McCarthy. I convinced him to take the class. And all of a sudden, I was able to take that first class for like $100 because she gave me that $50 off. And then I don't think she ever charged me again for classes.
Well, back then it was like two or three levels, I bet.
It was Sharna and Dell.
Okay.
But again, if you were somebody she wanted on teams or wanted to cultivate, she was, you know, I just don't remember cutting that many checks to her.
Did she notice your talent right away?
Yeah, after the very first scene that I did in her class, she was like, wanted to put us, Ian Roberts and I were in the same level one. And she wanted to put us, you know, on teams immediately. And he was like, yeah, I'll take it. And I was like, no, I'm just a writer. I'm taking this, class, advertising class. And I'm just trying to get more ideas for writing. Yeah. So I put it off for a long time. And then one Wednesday, I remember, I was like, all right, I'm done with the improv. I've taken the class. It's been fun. But I got to get a job. I got to get into something that's got a career aspect to it. And I loved advertising. And I was studying with these guys at the Ad Center who were great advertising, icons who taught classes there. She called me up and she said, listen, I'm putting up on a team. Are you going up Friday night? And I said, no, I think I'm done, Sharna. I appreciate it. I'm just going to do that. Don't be a pussy. You're going up Friday night. Show up at 8 o'clock. I said, all right, I'll think about it. And so that Friday night I went up and I showed up and I played with a team, TBA, to be announced. They didn't have a name yet. But Rich Fulcher was on the team. D. Ryan was on the team. Rich Sohn was on that team. And then within a month, she put me on The Family, and I started playing with The Family, Victim's Family at the time, and then after that, I...
And for people that don't know, The Family was a legendary improv team at IO Chicago. People like Adam McKay, Matt Besser, Ian Roberts, Neil Flynn, Miles Stroth.
Rachel Dratch, Rick Roman, Pete Holmley played with us for a while, yeah.
And you guys all had very strong personalities.
Yeah.
Very strong personalities.
Yeah, I think one of the things we talked about is one of the reasons it kind of worked is no one cared what anybody else thought of them. And that's kind of why it worked. And we never really rehearsed that hard until we were working with Dell with the two shows. We'd show up, we'd, you know, have some coffee, we'd talk. That would be our warm-up. No one liked warming up. And very little talking about shows afterwards. And we would just go up there and, you know, do our thing and then
what
drink.
What was that like for you? Because I have people that saw the show and they said sometimes Ali didn't get out there enough. Do you think that there was some truth with the family?
Yeah, I mean, even back then, I was just like, I was still working at Blockbuster when I started doing the improv. So I would take my lunch break at around 7:45, take the 22 bus up Clark, do the show, turn my Blockbuster shirt inside out, and then I'd go back to Blockbuster and I'd finish it. Because I just didn't think this thing was going to last. And it took a long time to get a job in Chicago for me.
So you're like, this is very interesting because I never knew. Because I just know Ali is this polished, charismatic performer. You were probably a little intimidated, right? And probably ambivalent, like, do I really want to be a performer at this point?
Yeah, I mean, when I did it, I loved doing it. I remember from the very first class and the very first scene, I can remember, it felt like breathing. Like, I was like, oh, yes, I like this. This is fun. But it still was hard for me to get past whatever stuff I had to really do it. And plus, you know, everyone on that team was very good, so you were running with wolves. So it's like, you know, somebody's going to come out last in the scene or, you know.
And then also at this time, you get involved with the Upright Citizens Brigade when they were in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know, like, the crazy stuff they were doing in Chicago. What kind of stuff were they doing early on in those days?
Well, I mean, I think that came out of just our desire to do more sketch. So I think it was 91, fall of 91, we started forming the group. And then we started doing shows at this place called Kill the Poets, which was like a poetry club. And they had a pool table in the back. And they let us do sketch shows at 11 o'clock at night there. But, I mean, the crazy stuff we did. One time we did a scene where it was on the four corners of the street. It was a Thanksgiving dinner, but done on the street as if this was not part of the dinner. And then we would throw a beach ball back and forth as the food. And then bouncers from other places would come out and oftentimes accost us, like, what are we doing screaming in the middle of the street at 11 o'clock at night? But we did stuff like that. Fake McKay suicide one week.
Adam McKay, you faked his suicide?
Yeah, he put flyers all over town. Adam McKay will be killing himself this week.
And then meet at a certain place?
No, we did this at Rudely Elegant. And then we got a stuffed, you know, replica of Adam and threw it off the top of the roof. One night, I remember we did this thing where Horatio got arrested.
Horatio Sands.
Yeah, he got arrested because we would do a road trip around New York, around Chicago. We'd take someone out of the audience, they'd be put in the car, and then Adam would take them on a road trip while we would do the show. And then during the Thanksgiving bit, Raj would cross the street, and Adam would hit the person in the car, hit Horatio in the car. That way everyone would know that it all did actually take place that night.
When you mean hit him, like...
You know, he would come close to him, Raj would hit the car, and then roll over.
Okay.
And I think something... Something happened where the cops were there, and they were like, you can't fake hit people with a car.
Well, there's a very well-known ordinance in Chicago that you can't do that.
Right. Yeah. But also, we did some... There was somebody, a politician named Rostenkowski, and we were doing some fake anti-Rostenkowski march. And Horatio was saying, kill Rostenkowski. And I remember they put him in a... They put him in a police car. They handcuffed him, put his head down, and I was like, uh-oh. And so I had to go in that night and do all the parts he did in our UCB show. But
and then shortly after that, you get hired by the Second City at the touring company.
Yeah, I don't know if it's shortly. I got to Chicago November 1st, 90. That's when I took the first writing class with Michael, and then I started doing improv with Sharna February 1st, 91. I guess it was probably a couple of years after that, two or three years after that. They hired Horatio first and then McKay. I mean, all of us had a disdain for it. We didn't really want to work for what we thought was the establishment.
So what changed your mind?
I guess we started wanting to get paid. And they were the only ones actually paying. And then, you know, that kind of exuberance and, like, that rebel youth. And then one day we were all going to see My Thing of Love at the Steppenwolf with Laurie Metcalf. On an afternoon, we took our headshots to get in for free. And they were like, you don't actually need your headshots. Just say you're an actor, we'll let you in for free. So then it was Ian was driving, and it was me, McKay, Horatio, and Ian. And then afterwards, we kind of like, I guess maybe Ian brought it up or someone brought it up as a bit. We should drop our headshots off at Second City for the auditions. We're like, all right, let's do it. And then we drove up to Second City, and Ian ran our headshots up to the office, and all of a sudden, that's how we signed up for their auditions.
And then you get in, and you're in a touring company, and you're in a touring company with Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Bill Codd, Kevin Dorff, and Rich Tallarico.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a great company. And what was that like?
Well, I mean, I knew, you know, I don't know why, but I was like, this is my main stage. I know, I don't
meaning?
Think, meaning, I don't think I'll get to a main stage just because of the way I was.
What was that at that time for people that don't understand?
I was still pretty rebellious. I was still a kid who was like probably longing to have been out at sea or a Vietnam War or a civil rights movement. So I rallied against the man, you know. But
and in improv, that would be the producer.
That would be the producers of, you know.
Kelly Leonard,
yeah,
Sharna.
Who were, you know, now, ironically enough, I play that role here, so I have to deal with some of that now, which is the universe. You know, there's no entity more humorous than the universe.
Right.
But it was just phenomenal, because I remember, like, so many moments. Like, I remember I came up with a blackout, and I told Dorff about it. And I was like, you think we could put it in the show, you know, next time? He's like, put it in the show next time. He's like, that's going in tonight. I was like, what? He was like, yeah. And so at one point, our show with that group was all original material except for one blackout called Bagpipe. They insisted we keep Bagpipe in because they really, this was the first time like a group was doing that much original writing. Usually you just did the material that was left behind.
It was the best of shows.
It was the best of. But I guess we were bored with that and everybody was on board to write original comedy, so we just kept doing it.
Did you... Did, like with Tina and Amy, did you go like, oh, these guys are going to go places or?
You know, I was just, again, I'm still naive to a lot of it. I don't think I thought that way. I knew they were super talented. I knew they were very nice, you know, and good people. I just don't know if I thought, I don't think, you know, maybe other people did, but I just never thought in terms of the next level, really. You know, once I got to Chicago, it was just doing improv and being part of that, and I just kind of let go of, you know, I'm not really that ambitious to begin with, you know, but I just don't know if I had, I saw things that way.
So then you're in the touring company and you get fired because a prom night happens. Can you tell us that story?
Well, I'd been touring for about 2.5 years, and I guess I was, you know, acting out in a way where I was just like, you know, again, looking for something to rail against. There was a prom show, and they said you couldn't say the F word at this prom show. And I had a sketch that I did called Big Mac that had the F word in it. And I was just like, you know, I don't know. There was a piece of me that was just like, the show's at 1 o'clock at night. This sketch I created, we tour on the road, and now we can't do it because these kids' teachers said we couldn't do it. And I'm like, they're 18 years old. They could technically go off to war. And now we're, in our minds, we can't say the F word in front of them. It just seemed like a lot of hypocrisy, and it seemed like a lot of just, you know, disingenuous to the social and political satire history of what Second City was to me. And so I went out there to begin the show, and I said, you know, I don't know if you guys know this, but your teachers told my handlers we're not allowed to use the F word in front of you. And all of a sudden, the kids erupted, F that, F high school, F Michigan. They went crazy. And they said I incited them to riot. Was the official, like, claim. And then when the scene came around, I was this close to them, and I was eating the Big Mac, and I said the F word in it. And then one kid in the front row said, I thought you weren't allowed to say that. I said, sometimes you just got to say, what the F? I used the F word. And they were like, you speak for us. We'll follow you into hell. And then the next Monday, I got a call.
From
Kelly. Kelly was like, hey, man, we need to talk. I'm like, all right, what's up? He's like, listen, dude, maybe I think it's time for you to come off the road. You know, you've been doing 2.5 years. We still consider you for a stage. When a spot comes in, we'll put you in. You know, it's just like right now, I think it's best for you to come off. I said, are you firing me? He's like, look, I'm not. It's just coming off the road, and, you know, it's... but are you firing me for what I did? And I was like, look, it's, we don't have to. It's not. And I kept pushing. And the police said, yes, if you want to say I'm firing you, fine. I go, all right, then I quit. You know, again, just like this childishness, this desire for, like, you know, I don't know, something like, you know, I guess, again, I keep going back to, like, you know, having, you know, I was a big fan of history in my youth. And not really having a civil rights movement or having a Vietnam War to march against, you looked for places to be like, this is wrong. And then again, in your mind, you're like, the last time he ever performed was when he worked as egg. And it's like, no one cares. That's what you realize after you do something like that. No one really cares.
When you look back, and now that you're in management, and do you look back and regret some of that stuff?
No. I mean, I did. If I knew better, I would have done better. It's all I knew, and, you know, it was, you know, youth. And it worked out because I ended up that, if I hadn't got let go, I wouldn't have moved out to L.A., you know, and seen what L.A. was. And then I got hired again, so I came back again. They rehired me, and then I did get fired again.
How'd you get fired the second time?
The second time I got fired, two friends were getting married in Los Angeles on the same day. I'd already used my vacation time to go to China for 2 weeks. And I said, look, I'd like to go to this wedding. They're like, you already used your vacation time. And again, I didn't have a sense. I never had, like, a real job. So they're like, you already had your time off. I was like, yeah, but there's understudies. I'm just going to fly to L.A. and come back. And they're like, they finally said, agreed. They said, okay, you can fly out Saturday morning, go to the two weddings, fly back Sunday, and be back for the show Sunday night. I said, okay, I can do that. That's the new, the more mature version of me was like, this is a compromise I can live with. You know, I would have liked to make it a longer trip, but okay. So I flew out Saturday morning, got there, went to the two weddings, had a great time. You know, an old girlfriend picked me up, and then I said to her, look, if I can hang out Sunday, do you want to hang out and just, you know, hang out for the day? And she was like, yeah, great. So I called my understudy, and I said, listen, can you do the show Sunday night? And I guess I just said, just in case something happens, can you do it? Because I'm flying to L.A. and coming back. Be prepared to go in. He said, yeah, it's no problem. God, I can't remember his name. What a great guy. Okay, so I ended up staying. Didn't come back for that Sunday show, and then I came back in time to go watch the improv set Sunday night. And when I came back, everybody was like, you got fired again. I'm like, what? Kelly fired you. You got fired. I'm like, what happened? And then this time I was like, look, the first time, okay, this is just a misunderstanding. But they'd already made the decision, and, you know, I talked to Andrew and I talked to Kelly, and they were like, no, we're not going to go back on this. And I think Andrew was like, look, I can't second guess his judgment. This is what the decision is. And Andrew, after I got fired the first time...
Andrew Alexander,
he came to visit me at the restaurant I was working at called Panicaldo, where I was just learning how to be a pastry chef for no reason.
So you get fired from Second City, and you go and you become a pastry chef?
I don't even become a pastry chef. I just, you know, I'm already working at that restaurant because I always kept multiple jobs.
So when you were at ETC, you were still working in a restaurant?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, look, ETC was Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I think after, you know, taxes, I don't know, that check might have been $350, $400. And I was a worker. And also, to me, I never wanted to rely on one place for all my income. And I also, you know, Dell would always say, if you only do this, this is all you'll know. Go out there and do other stuff. So I had a world in a restaurant where I was, you know, a bartender. I was a waiter, you know. I, you know, had a whole different people who had no idea what I did. So I always kept a job doing something on the side.
So you get fired from Second City, and then you get hired to write for Saturday Night Live. How does that happen?
Well, they came one night, as they do, to Second City to see talent. They saw Main Stage, they saw ETC. And I remember they put a sign up at ETC that said, FYI, SNL is coming Friday night at 11.
Now, does that freak you out?
No, it brings out the recovering smartass in me.
Okay.
Which is, I circle FYI and go, so what am I supposed to do with this information? Do a different show that I've been doing every night? You know, so to me, it was like, I'm doing the best I can every
I love
night.
How angry you got about it.
I got angry. There's a piece of me that got angry, too. It's like, I don't want to know that anybody's there. I just want to do the show. So, and I guess for them, it's like, we're just letting you know they're coming. Don't make a big deal out of it. It's like, but to me, it's like, I just want to do the show. So that week, I was listening to NPR, and I heard this piece about how the fastest humans in the world don't run 100 meters the fastest. They run 50 meters the fastest and then take the longest amount of time to slow down. At 50 meters, you can't go any faster. If you try, you'll injure yourself. So I was into the cross-pollination of ideas, and I said, how does this affect me? I said, all right, do the show you've been doing. Don't try to get bigger and punch it and louder. And so that 11 o'clock show, it was like half filled, ETC, 11 o'clock. And I just did the show.
Did you know where they were in the audience, or you didn't
care? They were on the rail, probably.
Okay.
You know, but I mean, well, I can't like play to, you know, right. You still got to do the show. But then I saw my good and very talented friends start doing what that, you know, that piece from NPR said.
What did they do?
They tried to get a little bigger, a little louder, eyes bulged a little bit more, and all of a sudden you saw...
Upstaging.
On stage. And just got a little bit like they'd have misspeaks and missteps. And all of a sudden, those little fissures, you know, I mean, I don't know what would have happened if anything had gone differently, but the show went well. I had a good show, even though it was a small house. Afterwards, Steve Higgins came up to me and said, hey, man, that was a great show.
And he was like the head writer then?
He was the producer.
Okay.
I mean, but he was right under Lorne as the producer. He said, look, that was a great show. Send me all your writing. We're not looking for a male performer this year. We're looking for one female performer.
Now, this is your dream job. How are you feeling when this is happening?
I'm like, this is the dream. Mm-hmm. This is happening. And all of a sudden, it was like, okay. And he was a nice guy. We hit it off very quickly. We became very friendly. And that night, Steve, myself, Horatio, and Scott Wainio, who was in town, who was a very gifted writer at SNL, we ended up going to Wontitan's Burritos, which is still one of the best burritos in Chicago, on North and Pulaski. He said, send me all your writing. I'll put it together in a packet. I'll put the best four things together for you. They're not looking for a male performer. They're looking for one female performer. But if they do audition male performers, I'll have them fly you up. I said, all right, great. So I sent him all my stuff. And then he said, look, we're going to look at some guys, so we'll fly you up for an audition. And I was like, freaking out. And then I went to my director, Jeff Richmond, and I said, listen, can you help me put this together? He said, yeah. So I freaked out for a day, Wednesday, when I found out. Thursday, I began working on it. And for me, what worked best was, you know, putting together in the form of a script, a five-minute script.
And then you have to have like three characters and a couple impressions.
Three characters, three impersonations. And I really didn't do impersonations, so I went with what do I sound like. So I ended up doing a Christopher Walken, Robert De Niro, and Jean Reno.
Who's Jean Reno?
Jean Reno is, he was in films, he's a French actor, and he was in films like The Specialist, I think. He plays an assassin, he plays in the Mission Impossible movies. But then he went like Jean Reno, he talks like this.
And how was your walking?
My walking was just like, again, I think it's the writing more than anything. It was Christopher Walken for Pampas Diapers, you know.
Like, and then De Niro? You know?
De Niro was for Disney. It was just like, you know, I can't. You know, Robert De Niro for Disneyland. You know, take your kids to Disneyland. You know, something like that. You know. But I wrote up the three things. So I think in that they saw the writing. You know, the performing was, I guess, what it was. But after that, you know, Lorne got up and shook my hand and said, nice job. And I was like, wow. And then afterwards, they were like, that went well. And it felt good, you know. And I remember before I went in, you know, Horatio and Tina were on the other side of the door at 8H. And they gave me a hug. And I said, all right, I'll see you on the other side. And the night before, Horatio took me to 8H. And we walked around the space together.
Did that help?
Oh, it helped immensely. I got to go backstage. I went onto the monologue stage where I was going to do it. So I'd seen it. Second City gave out these little chairs as a Christmas gift one year. Like the Second City.
The Bentwood chairs.
So I used those, that little Bentwood chair, and I would put it there, and I would use that to visualize the audition. So I would just use that chair and where I would stand and where I would get up and do it, you know, because I knew my talent was limited and that I could, if this was going to happen, it was going to happen because of my force of will of rehearsing and practicing.
When you say your talent is limited, what do you mean by that? Your on-stage talent?
Yeah, I mean, look, I know where, to some degree, where I stand in the big scheme of things.
Where do you?
What's that?
Where do you stand?
Well, somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
Somewhere in the middle. But
you were saying, in terms of a performer, this was the time, if it was any time, it was going to happen?
If it was ever going to happen, this was the moment. You know, it was here and now, this one week of what I was going to do that week, how I was going to practice, how I was going to rehearse. I mean, again, it's like my friend, Steve Higgins, and I became friendly. Tina and I were friends. Horatio was on the show. Jeff Richmond, who was at the time dating Tina, or maybe married at the point, he was my director. He was helping me. Like, everything aligned. It was the 25th anniversary season. I was already at a place where I was practicing this thing every night, you know. So it was one of those things where it's like, this is it. This is that window of opportunity. And if you do not do what you can to prepare for it, you'll regret it. And so I did everything I could. Like I said, I know, like someone like Jimmy Fallon, you know. His audition is like, I'm going to do, you know, this character, and he does a killer character. And he can do 30 characters like that, you know. So he's just gifted like that. So for me, I knew I was just going to have to do it, show what I could do through my writing and through my again, just commitment and joy and having fun.
So they offer you a job, and you write for the 25th season, right? The 25th year?
Yeah.
Now, when I say this, there seems to be a little sadness about that.
No, I mean, there was a 25th anniversary season, so it's like, you know, I was there 3 weeks beforehand, and they were prepping for the 25th, and then the 25th happened that Sunday night, and then it was like, for everybody there, there's a certain feeling of like a Sisyphus. Now it's 25th anniversary is done. You had the prom before senior year. Now you got to push the rock up the hill. So I was the only writer hired. You know, the only two new people hired that year was myself and Rachel Dratch was the one female performer that got hired, and we were office mates. So I guess I was like a cherry in Vietnam. I was just like, you know, so happy to be there, you know, wagging. And people who was the closest to us were a year and a half. So I think they were over it, but still knew what an amazing job it was.
When you look back at that experience, would you have done anything differently? Because you eventually get fired, right? But
yes. Three people got let go a week before Christmas. Myself, Jerry Collins, and J.J. Philbin. I got a call from Steve Higgins when I was visiting Chicago, you know, as I was apt to do, you know, between breaks. And he said, look, buddy, I'm sorry, but, you know, just, you know, it's too many writers. NBC told us to cut our budget. And we got to let go of three writers. Last hired, first fired. I said, Steve, is there anything I could have done? He goes, no, there's nothing you could have done. Anything I could have done different? No.
How was that day? Your dream of 9 years.
It was rough.
And how did you deal with it?
It was rough with a lot of depression. I was just like, wow. And I went back to North Carolina for Christmas.
Now, when you say depressed, it's hard for me to believe. How do you get depressed?
I mean, I do. I mean, I have seasonal depression now. I mean, I get, like, low and, you know.
Do you drink? Do you medicate at that time?
Yeah, I was drinking back then, so I probably definitely drank. I kept it to myself, I think. I told the people I was staying with. I had friends who lived in Chicago for my fraternity who I always crashed in their apartment. And I told them. And when they told me. They said, some guy named Steve Higgins called you. He left a message to call him back. And I was like, oh, shit, I got fired. They're like, what? I was like, there's no reason why he would be calling me a week before Christmas. There's no reason. And I remember calling him, and one of his kids picked up. Daddy, it's Ali. It's like, all right. I can't remember his kid's name. John, Sarah, go. Daddy's got to have a very serious talk right now.
Is your heart pounding at this point?
Yeah. And I'm like, okay. And I partied hard that night in Chicago because it was one of those, you get to come home to the place where you were, and you write for SNL, and you went out the night before.
Yeah.
And you've got more money than you've ever had, which is not a lot of money, but it's more money than you've ever had. You know, not you, but I'm saying me, you know. And so, you know, I mean, I'm not saying it was, the season had a lot of amazing moments. I'm not saying it wasn't challenging. And at SNL, they always say it takes a year. If you get one sketch on all year, you'll be lucky and we'll be happy. But the conversation was probably a minute and a half. He was very, you know, gracious about it. And he had to make a tough call. You know, I always wondered why they had to do it a week before Christmas, because my contract was till the end of February, but it's like...
Well, you got still paid, right?
I still got paid through the end of February. But had I not got let go then, you know, then I wouldn't have been available in February when my friend Alex Young called and said, my wife and I are going to look at some apartments. Why don't you come with us? I'm like, nah, dude, I'm good. And I was like staying up all night partying, sleeping all day, and he knew how bad the cycle had gotten.
You're in New York or Chicago?
I'm in New York at this point. And I'm crashing with my sister. She had an apartment here. She was already working here. I went to look at the apartments with him, and I don't know why. The broker and I hit it off, Vicky Musso, and I said, you got anything for a working actor between $1 and $1.50? And she was like, yeah, I got a great apartment on 50th for $150. I was like, what? I was like, all right, I'll look at it. I never thought for $150 you could get an apartment in New York City.
What year is this, about 90?
This is 2000. Okay. This is 2000. And then all of a sudden, through a series of, again, working hard, knowing when to work hard, I ended up buying that place for $1.35. So if I hadn't got let go, I wouldn't have bought that apartment. Before my second daughter, Olivia, was born, my wife said, I'm not going to live in a walk-up with two. And I said, all right, but this place was built in the 1860s. I mean, people have raised families. That was a non-starter, you know. So that's when we sold that apartment at the top of the market. And then that's money is what I ended up using to...
How did you have money to buy the apartment in the first place?
Well, SNL. I had, you know.
Wasn't it like $5,000 a week then?
No, it was. They gave me a $5,000 signing bonus. I think my check was $2,541 a week, which came out to $1,400 a week after taxes. And I was living with my sister. She wasn't charging me rent because she was like.
So you were just saving money.
I was just saving money. And so I was just saving money. And I always, since I was younger, I was pretty good at saving money. especially after college, where I had some gambling issues and I had to, you know, save and raise money very quickly. But she let me crash with her, and she was just like, just pay utilities. She was an attorney, so she didn't, she got it. Like,
so you buy this place in New York, and you start teaching for the UCB, right? And
yeah.
Performing?
Yeah, I was doing ASCAT. Even while at SNL, I was doing ASCAT every Sunday, two shows. And then I was also, you know, then afterwards I started, you know, teaching again.
And there's a legendary story, and I want your side of it, where you, towards the end of your time at the UCB teaching, you had this great reputation, but you... One class, you asked people to go out and paint a fire hydrant. Is this true?
No, not okay. That. What I did is I said, look, we're going to warm up anyway. Let's spend this warm up going outside. I brought gloves and I brought garbage bags, and we're just going to clean the street between, I think it was Cap 21 where the class was. And we're just going to clean the street. It's a silent exercise. No talking to each other. No talking to, you know, anybody who says anything, just smile at them. And for about 45 minutes to an hour, we cleaned the street between 26 and 27.
Okay, what was the point of the exercise for students?
I mean, to me, it was just like a warm-up is just a way to warm up and connect people. And again, I was also at the point is if I had an idea, I followed through with the idea. I didn't try to second-guess myself. And again, I was naive to think that I couldn't do this or this would be a big deal. Because at that point, UCB was so new, there weren't that many of us teaching. I didn't think it was like that big a deal to go out in the street with your class and clean the street.
Where did I get the fire hydrant painted?
After 9/11.
Okay.
Again, there was this feeling of like, oh my God, what can I do to help? I started going out and painting fire hydrants bright red, just to do something. And then I'd splatter paint them with a little blue and white.
But you never asked the class to do it?
I never asked the class to paint a fire hydrant. I remember one day I was painting a mailbox on 29th Street, and Rich Holman walked by.
Rich Holman
is one of the performer instructors here, and he said, what are you doing? I told him, like, you know, we are on this block, so whenever they get graffitied, I come out and paint the mailboxes. And then I think he helped me, but I didn't make them. You know, I never made anybody.
Did you ever get in trouble for that? Did they ever ask you, like, you got to paint over it or anything like that?
No, and we still paint the mailboxes, or, you know, Stephen Washington or the folks at Simple Studios, we still paint the mailboxes on 29th between 6th and 7th when they get graffiti.
Then you have to make a hard decision.
Yeah.
You break away from the UCB.
Yeah. I don't know if it was a hard decision. It seemed like it was time to put out a shingle. You know, if I look back on it, you know, it's like in olden times. I had apprenticed for, at that point, maybe over a decade. I'd apprenticed with Improv Olympic, with Sharna and Dell. I'd apprenticed at the Second City with Kelly and Andrew and all the, you know, instructors there. And then with UCB, again, it was an apprenticeship. And it just felt like it was time. And again, it was post 9/11, which is very hard for people, I think, who weren't in New York or even in New York, I don't know. There was a sense of, like, what now? What am I going to do with my skill set and my, you know, things that I can offer? And it just felt like it was time to start something.
Was it hard to, because it started kind of a riff, would you say?
Yeah, I mean...
Was it hard in terms of, they're my friends, we all came from Chicago, and I'm starting this thing, and we're not talking? Was that hard at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I'm not that good at confrontation to begin with, and it was one of those things that just kept building up, and I don't want to necessarily go in... There's no real reason to go into the details of how it actually happened right now, but they were my best friends, you know? But I also felt like I'd done everything I could there. I remember my last night doing ASCAT. They didn't know, but I knew it was my last night. There was 13 people on stage. The audience was packed. And I was, like, looking around, enjoying it, going, you don't need me anymore. And I remember, like, a sense of just, with the fraternity at Carolina, I was the house manager. So I was in charge of one of my positions, in charge of how the place looked, the landscaping, you know, building shelves, keeping everything, you know, fixed. And I was the house manager for probably 2 years. I was also the treasurer of that fraternity and assistant treasurer. So I wanted to have a say in how the place looked. And I knew I wouldn't have a say in how the place looked in terms of being able to, if I wanted to do hardwood floors or paint or do any kind of art. And I don't know, it just felt like I wanted to do more teaching, I wanted to do more performing, and it felt like it was time. And I think the only thing that kept it from not happening earlier in New York is that New York real estate is so onerous. It's a challenging proposition to open up a space in New York, or someone else would have already done it.
Would you say, and this is total dime store psychology on my part, that Ali Farinakian is a leader, he likes to be his own man, and he was not going to get that opportunity at UCB?
You know, honestly, it was never my dream to have a theater, to be a leader. I always saw myself more as a general in someone else's army. I mean, you know, if anybody I, you know, connected with, I connected probably with Grant, U.S. Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, more than I did with Lincoln. You know, and so there was, I didn't want, and I also like the, I like the movie Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and I like the idea of James Spader. He said, I have one key, that's all I want. And then when he got that second key for his car key and the apartment key, he was like, ugh. And now I've got like, you know, a whole keychain around my belt with a bunch of keys on it. So again, it was not something that was my dream, you know, and I don't know if I was a natural leader. Throughout my life, it has been put on me. And when it has, it's like, okay, I guess I'm going to be the captain of the tennis team because these guys elect you as the captain.
Have you ever, like, tried to reach out to those guys?
You know, years later when I was doing Homebody Cobble at the Steppenwolf, and the first act was Amy Morton doing a phenomenal,
wonderful
50-minute monologue. And then after that, I would go and do an autopsy of the woman you just seen. This is her autopsy. After that first scene, I was done. So after that, I had to find things to do so I wouldn't go crazy. So I wrote letters to the four of them, and I sent it out. For me, it was like, it was my way of like, I tried to reach out in different ways, and to me, it was like, I need to find some closure for myself and to say, here's where I could have done better, and here are the reasons I chose to do it. But it was individual letters to the four of them.
Because, you know, how could you have done better, do you think?
Well, I could have probably told them that it was happening before it happened. I could have been the one to tell them that it was happening. But again, there was a piece of me that just wanted to maintain the age of innocence as long as I could.
Was it innocence or was it some fear?
There was fear, yeah. I didn't want to have a confrontation. And it was just something that it felt like it had to happen. And I just kind of avoided it. And I avoided the difficult conversation with them. And, you know, I ended up, you know, talking to a few of them afterwards, but again, it was like 12 plus years ago, so I go back to those memories, I have to think about it a little bit.
And now we have three theaters, long-form theaters, Magnet, Pitt, UCB. How do you see the Pitt is different from the other theaters?
Well, I mean, one thing I would say is that, you know, had we not broken off to start the Pitt, the other ones wouldn't have happened, and now there's other theaters here, too, so I think it's a good thing that other theaters pop up. And I have to keep reminding myself that because...
Do you ever feel threatened by the other theaters?
Look, each of us struggles with the ego and the soul. Mm-hmm. The soul wants as many theaters as possible because we can only accommodate so much. The ego is afraid. Mm-hmm. So with each of us, including myself, I have to struggle with that fear. But I realize that fear is not my soul. It's not my spirit. It's my ego that's scared of not getting enough love because now there's other theaters opening.
Your ego feels a little threatened.
Yeah, but that's you know, again, that's, I think it's natural when new places pop up. How will this affect us? How will it affect us financially? Because again, to keep these going concerns going in New York City, the landlord, Con Ed, they don't care what we're doing in here. They don't care if this is an Italian restaurant, a comedy theater, or a saddle shop. They don't care. They want their rent every month, every 30 days. Con Ed wants their money. So I have a fiduciary responsibility to the places that I oversee as a shepherd of the funds to keep it going.
So how is the Pitt different than the Magnet in UCB?
I don't, again, at this point, know enough about the other two.
Okay. Well, you spent time at UCB.
Right. But again, that was 12 years ago.
Okay.
I mean, look, I can't say how we're different because I don't know what they are, really.
Okay, tell me what the philosophy of the Pitt is.
Well, I mean, hopefully, I mean, a big part of what we do is community. You know, for me, I've gone from fraternity to fraternity my entire life, whether it was the tennis team or the dorm I lived in or the fraternity I was in Carolina or Improv Olympic or Second City or SNL or UCB or the Pitt. It's a fraternity, you know, of sorts where, you know, again, the goal is what happens on these stages. You know, and I could say a sentence like, the goal is to make improvised material look like it's scripted and scripted material look like it's improvised. I could say, you know, something like, we are a theater that focuses on comedic improvisational theater. You know, but it's a place, you know, like all of them, which are shells for people to have friends, have a community, work on their craft, you know, do as much or as little as they want to further their cause as a human being and an artist, you know. So I don't, you know, hopefully it's a place with heart. Hopefully it's a place where people like each other, you know, and they get along, and we try to hopefully keep the drama to a minimum and the an a-hole quotient to the very minimum, you know.
How do you do that? How do you keep the a-hole quotient to the minimum?
I can't dismiss that, obviously, as long as I'm alive, it will be the fish rots from the head down either way. So I have to, you know, maintain. Yeah, it either is going to rot from the head down or it'll be inspired. So I have to be cool and kind of wear the, you know, very light, like at Second City, they said, you know, wear your character lightly like a light feather boa or a light hat. You know, so it's like this whole idea of being the owner, what do I really own? You know?
Well, my question is, why not say I'm the owner of this place?
If the landlord walked in here, or the NYPD or FDNY, I would say I am the owner of the pit. I would say it if they walked in. But aside from that, there's no real reason to say it. I perform here on Wednesdays. I teach here. I'm one of the teachers here. I try to help out how I can with the people who do the thankless work of cleaning the space and overseeing it. But you have to wear it lightly. You know, it's that old saying of, you know, when you tear down the statues, keep the pedestals. They come in handy, you know. So it's like at some point when I'm not a part of this anymore, you know, whether I've passed or moved on to something else, hopefully it'll still be the People's Improv Theater, and hopefully they will have found a way to keep it going. As I said, like, you know, the challenge in New York is real estate. When this lease comes up in any of the spaces, let's try to keep another 10-year lease. Let's try to do another 10-year one. But again, you have to wear it lightly because, you know, if you're not humble about it, it's very easy for it to get in your way.
All right, I know this is going to be hard, but we're going to improvise. Oh, all right?
Jeez, all right.
All right.
Well, we've been doing that, but all right.
Yeah, we have been, but we're going to do a scene. All right? Okay. So we're going to take a suggestion. If you're beat, we can go like 5 minutes.
Whatever you want. Yeah, okay. I'm going to do the best I can.
Okay. Okay. I appreciate it. So can we have a suggestion?
Stairmaster.
All right, so when you hear Stairmaster, what do you do with that suggestion?
I immediately want to get on a Stairmaster.
Okay.
Or a treadmill.
Okay.
You know, so when I hear the suggestion, I think, okay, Stairmaster. That makes me think of, I try to think of what to do first.
Mm-hmm.
How can I add that to the where?
Okay.
As opposed to Stairmaster. Because, again, language is just one of those things where it's like, it's such a limiting thing. So if I think Stairmaster and try to come up with some funny premise or something, it's like, it's too hard for me. I don't work that way. I just think of, like, start doing something in the Stairmaster makes me think of.
Okay, great. Let's go. And then we'll call the scene.
Okay. You're looking great, man.
Thanks, man.
I'm gonna get off this thing for a second.
You just got off.
I know.
You told me to time you, and then you just got off.
I know, but it's just like I've seen those videos where people do a lot of dancing on these things.
You gotta shut it off, man.
I should shut it off.
You just keep going.
I know. You've done some serious shape shifting over the past years.
Yeah.
God, it seems like I just yo-yo.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you'd stay in the Stairmaster for more than like 40 seconds, maybe you'd burn some calories.
I know.
You know, Bart, you keep bugging me. You're like, oh, I want to lose the weight. I want to lose weight. And then you don't even exercise.
I know. I think I more want to talk about losing the weight.
Okay.
But there's other thing I wonder.
What?
My wife saw this advertisement.
Sally?
Oh, what's this?
Sally.
Yeah, Sally. She saw this advertisement. I guess whether it was a newspaper or something, some doctor for March Madness is doing 2-for-1 vasectomies.
Right, Dr. Fishman.
Yes,
Dr. My wife gave me the same.
She did.
It's a Groupon.
Right, because they said it's a good time to recuperate.
Yes.
While you're watching March Madness, get these vasectomies.
Right.
Done.
Yeah.
And I said, who do I know that I'm going to go up to someone and say, hey, you want to partake in this 2-for-1 vasectomy?
How long have you been sitting on that? You know I'd be in.
This morning is when she, you know, she brought it up, and then I didn't want sitting on that long.
Well, next week I'm taking the whole week off, anyways.
All right, I'm not gonna lie to you; it scares me.
Okay.
It feels like, you know, it takes away a lot of my power, and if something happened between Sally and I, then, you know, what good am I?
You've got 4 kids. What does it matter at this point?
I know, but if you end up with someone else, part of it's going to be, can you, you know, I know what you've done. I know what you're capable of.
But you are not going to end up with anybody else. I mean, you're lucky to get sales.
You're right. You're right. I'm lucky to get anybody. Jesus. I'm a real piece of work.
What are you trying to do?
Just get my shoulders a little firmer.
Well, you're doing it all wrong.
Show me. Teach me.
Okay, here. First of all, these are like 2-pound weight. What do
you mean? You know, but my muscles don't know that. I mean, I know they're 2 pounds. And, you know, believe me, you know, the guy over there knows they're 2 pounds. But he's a monster, and I know he's
just... Do you want to lift these weights, or do you just want to talk about lifting weights?
Honestly, I'd rather talk about them. I prefer conversation to actual work.
Yeah. That's why you don't have a job.
You know what? I'm retired. Yeah, I'm in a pretty bad place right now.
Yeah.
Daddy's got to get it together.
Yeah. Sally's been calling me. And Jenny, your oldest, they're worried about you.
What? I'm thinking about going to India.
They told me.
You know,
they said it's just another opportunity for you to run away from your responsibilities.
But I mean, you get these emails from like Expedia and whatever, and you're like, what if I just click yes, I'll take this trip? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but you have 4 kids. You got 2 in high school and 2 in grade school.
Right.
Yeah, but you're just going to leave? You haven't worked now for 4 years.
God, what an amazing time it's been.
But I mean, have you seen me on the guitar lately?
I've seen
three chords in the truth.
Yeah, I've seen it. I went to the open mic.
You saw that?
Yeah. I saw.
You think those guys are gonna stop playing chess for a minute to listen to me play? They just kept playing chess. They were like 3 feet away from me.
Do you remember when the end when people were throwing things at you?
Yeah, and I was catching them, throwing them back.
Okay.
I got hands like that.
I understand, but that is a sign that you don't have talent. Why don't you call up Stu, all right? Call up Stu and ask for your job, man.
It's been 4 years, but you know what? Let's do it. I'll call Stu.
Do you want to call Stu, or you want to just talk about calling Stu?
Right? Honestly, I'd like to talk about him. But I'm willing to call him. Hey, man, I appreciate it.
I'm worried about you. I really, really am worried about you.
I mean, if you need to gnaw on this nice, juicy, worry steak, I'm not going to stop you.
I'm going to do it.
Okay, all right.
I'm worrying about you because you don't worry about yourself.
Why don't we both take a trip? You ever been to Myrtle Beach?
Oh, for God's sake. Bart, is that your solution, is go to Myrtle Beach? On a trip?
Yeah, to travel. A walkabout, as the Aussies say.
You don't have any money.
Who needs money when you got
your
legs?
Okay, fine, I'm in. You know what? I'm not going to be the guy since college that has always said no to your ideas. I am in. We're going to Myrtle Beach with no money. Uh-huh. We're going to be hobos. We're going to go down to the rail yard, and we're going to jump in a boxcar, and we're going to go to Myrtle Beach.
God, I love it.
Yeah, I'm totally in. Get our knapsacks and put a stick on the end, and we'll put black thing on our face, and we'll eat.
I think that happens naturally. I don't know if I want to be traveling in blackface. I mean, I think the soot just happens.
I'm talking about being a hobo.
Right.
Okay?
But I don't know if like hobo's just like, I'm going to be a hobo, I'm going to just do this. I'm a warrior.
Okay, fine.
Just
fine.
So much time near
fine.
The rails.
Okay.
Pause.
Okay, I'm in.
Okay.
I'm in. It's you and I.
Okay. All right. Jesus. Thank you. Jesus, you called my bluff.
Yeah.
You actually called my bluff.
Yeah.
I'm on Myrtle Beach.
Yeah.
Hobo style.
Yeah. So let's get going. All right.
Okay, we'll need a bandana, stick.
I got it in the car. Got it in the car. We'll drive my minivan. We'll park it right by the rail yard. And we'll get right in.
We'll jump.
What's the matter? You having second thoughts?
No. I mean, yeah, but no. Everybody has
said. Mr. Free Spirit, let's go.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Lead the way.
I'm leading the way.
Okay, where's
waiting
your car?
Waiting for you. My car's in the lot.
Let's go to your car.
We'll go.
Should I start walking towards it?
I was waiting.
Okay, all right. Take care, Juice Monkey.
This is happening.
Nice minivan. Thanks. I tried to get her, get Sally to get an Odyssey one year.
You know how you get a minivan? Huh. You actually make payments.
Okay. All right.
So where do you want to go for our last meal?
Last meal? I thought we'd just get a can of beans and do it on the rail. Okay. We're doing hobo style, right?
Right.
Hobo is still cool to say.
Hobo is cool to say. You don't say homeless, okay?
You don't say homeless.
No.
Hobo is like a fun version?
Yeah.
It seems like it's a choice thing.
Yes, yes.
Homeless is not by choice. Hobo is by choice.
Right, yes. Right.
It's exactly. Power.
Yes.
I mean, until we actually run across some hobos, we won't know. No. I'll have to ask.
Right.
Engage in some conversation.
And I will not do the blackface thing. You can throw the charcoal out when we get there.
Okay. All right. Wow. I feel alive.
I do too.
This feels right.
Yeah, it
feels
does.
Like real Thelma and Louise.
Yeah. Who am I? Which one?
I'm Thelma.
Okay.
Yeah, I know the movie, but not well enough to remember who was who.
I never saw the movie.
But you know the reference.
Yeah. They were lesbians, right?
No.
They were? Why do I get that as a misconception?
Because
that
of society. What? Because we're all brainwashed, and they said if two women go off on their own and leave their men, they got to be lesbians. They're not. I mean, one of them hooked up with Brad Pitt in the movie, I mean. Susan Sarandon, right?
Yeah.
And Gina Davis, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was his breakout movie for Brad Pitt. And he had that as abs before anybody did. Jesus, how do you even get those?
You lift up weights.
I know. If it was easy, everybody would do it, right? Everybody be in great shape.
We're here. I just want to say something. If something happens to me, you're my best friend.
Thank you. You too, man. And if something happens to me out there, just burn me.
What did you think?
This seemed fun. I like improvising.
Okay.
Fun, you know. Hopefully people were entertained a little bit.
Would you have done anything differently?
No. I mean, geez, Louise, it's happening so fast. You're trying to listen. Object work, there's some dude. You're trying, you know. No, you can't. I mean, I don't think you can second guess.
You never come off a show or a scene and go, I could have done it this way. I wish I would have made that choice.
Sure. I mean, yeah. But again, it's like I've been doing it for a while. So we had enough nice moments in there.
Okay.
And enough fun that I don't want to look at the stuff that could I have done things differently. Yeah, but I'm not doing sketch comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing improvisational comedy. You're doing the best you can in the moment to try to take all the things you learned about saying yes to somebody, listening and reacting and having fun, you know. And just doing the best you can to entertain.
Now, a scene like that, which is basically relationship-based, are you looking for a game in the scene? How do you approach something like this?
No, I mean, I don't even know if I would know how to do a game, you know, really. I mean, I get it. And we people have games. Like, you see people in life, and you have a nickname for them. You say their nickname. They say your nickname. So we obviously play games in life. But a scene like that, I don't think there's a game. There's no game there. Like, there, I think it's just two guys. It's a relationship. It's a moment in time. And, you know, it's like, you know, I don't think it's a game-based scene.
You know why I like to work off you is in that scene is because you bring emotion to it as an actor. And there was a couple times where I like, oh, he seems like he doesn't want to go. That, to me, is very helpful. The thing I wish I would have done better was early on gotten behind your idea of going on a trip. I felt like, oh, this guy's saying a lot of no, which is okay, but the scene's not going to go anywhere if it's just me complaining about you being such a fuck-up.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you do the best you can, then at some point you realize it's never the wrong time to do the right thing, and then you get on board and you do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, it's like you're talking about this thing is such a, it's like a sport. It's so raw. There's no way to be like, you know, perfect.
So you're almost saying like, okay, I experienced like, okay, I should have said no, or I shouldn't say. It would have been a good choice to say yes. It didn't work. So just say yes. Just keep self-correcting your mistakes.
And for the other person, just keep trying to get that yes.
Mm-hmm.
Keep fighting for your yes if it's something you really want. Just keep fighting for it. Try to get that person to say yes to that thing you want to do. You know, because that's what you, if it's what you really want. I mean, I don't know. It's all made up, coming from just like a suggestion of Stairmaster, and then you're there, and it's like, it's still crazy to me.
I don't know. I had a good time. I really enjoyed myself. We're going to put the house lights on, and got a lot of questions for you. I can't believe it. A lot of hands are up. I've never seen this many questions, so we'll start right here.
Yeah, hi, Ollie. My name is Stuart, and I just want to ask you a quick question. Throughout the interview, you're talking about how you started as a writer, and that was what really brought you to New York and doing things. And then at some point during the interview, all of a sudden, there's really not much of a mention of writing. So my question is, do you still write, or have you just kind of shifted into being a caretaker and just shifted focus?
Well, I mean, I still write for myself, you know, whether it's journaling or writing down ideas. But at this point, it's more helping other people with their writing. I teach a sketch writing class here. So as I say in the class, I'd rather help 12 people write a sketch than write one right now. But if someone paid me to write sketch comedy or paid me to write, and depending if it's the right situation, I'd be happy to write. I mean, I enjoy writing. But, you know, I have a limited amount of bandwidth, and I have two daughters, and, you know, there's five spaces we oversee. So, I mean, again, I'm making excuses. I should find time to write on a daily basis. But writing is hard work. It's farming. And what I do with this stuff is more hunter-gatherer. So, I mean, I have utmost respect for writers who, it's a daily thing you have to do. And I don't know if I'm wired that way. I mean, it's possible to rewire myself, but, yeah.
Great. Another question? Great, right over here.
Everyone has their own way of responding to a bad show. One of my mentors is Pam Victor, who is working or was working with TJ and Dave on their book, and she hit me with a gem a couple months ago after I had like a terrible show. She was like, sold for 24 hours and then just forget it completely and bounce back up. What would either of you, or what are your perspectives on responding to a bad show?
I would say sulk for 24 seconds, if that. You know, again, I've been doing this long enough where it's like I'm not even looking for a perfect show or a perfect scene or a good scene or a good show. I'm looking for maybe one moment. If that one moment happens where it was like that was worth coming out, and hopefully that moment happens on stage. That moment can happen before the show. It could happen after the show. It could happen on my walk to get here to do a show. Hopefully it's happening in the show. And if it happens in the show and I have one moment where I was like, okay, I listened when instead of interrupting. I said yes when I might have said no. I had one moment that felt like, yes, it's, I'm juggling, we're doing it. Then that's enough. You know, it's. I think in my youth I wanted to have the perfect show. And I mean, even with the groups I performed with, like the family and stuff like that, I mean, those shows that you really remember, over the course of the 5 years we were together, maybe a dozen whole shows that were like, wow. And I think that's even probably overestimating.
Great. Another question? Right here.
Hi. So you still teach, you perform, and you run a bunch of businesses. Does that come from your desire, as you said, to kind of always have multiple jobs? Or does it come from somewhere else? And how do you manage all of that?
Well, I prefer a buffet to an entree. I mean, you know. So all of it came out of just, it's inertia. It was not some design or some plan. And they just kind of organically grew this way. And with anything that grows organically like that, will eventually, over time, collapse. So hopefully it's still in a growing phase and not in this. And the way I guess I do the best I can, but it's like there are so many talented, good people here who actually do the heavy lifting of running the spaces, you know, of each of the spaces, whether it's, you know, the pit, you know, with the classes or the shows or, you know, Pioneers or Simple Studios or the Treehouse Theater. It's like they're real people doing the cleaning, the upkeep, the classes, the organ. And what I try to do is just try not to get in the way and try to, you know, help where I can and, you know, input my ideas. For me, a lot of it's the intangibles, you know. The tangibles are making sure the lights and sound and everything work, and I leave it to them. They tell me something's broken. If we have the money, get it fixed. But it's like trying to do the art and putting artists to work and how the design looks. And that's where I was telling Jimmy, you know, it allows me to do some architecture, some design, some interior decorating, you know, and that's what I like about them because I can't do any of it at home because my wife runs the show there. So here's where I get to, you know, play a little bit.
We got to wrap this up. This has just been a great, great time. Give us one piece of advice you would give to an improviser starting out today.
Well, I would say if you like it, do it. Get up on stage as much as you can. You want to become a great golfer, play a lot of golf, watch great golfers. If you want to become a better improviser, do a lot of improv, watch a lot of improv. You know, and as many nights a week as you can, fill that time with doing improv or watching it, whether it's rehearsals or classes. And again, there's this sense of like, you know, people want it a little more quickly than I think we did. And we were willing to maybe, you know, study for a little longer because, as I was saying, like when I was in Chicago, aside from studying with Sharna and Dell, I also studied at the Center Theater with Marianne Thebus and Martha Leif.
Well, so, that was Meisner technique.
Right. So I would say take acting classes, take improv classes, take other kinds of classes, immerse yourself in it, and be willing to be an apprentice for a period of time and dedicate the same amount of time you would if you were in school or pursuing a craft like electricity or plumbing. Give it the same amount and give yourself 3 to 5 years if you really want to do it, and do it because you enjoy doing it more than anything.
3 to 5 years?
I mean, to find out, again...
That doesn't mean you're going to master it in three to five years.
It would take you a decade minimum.
How long did it take you just to feel like, you know what, I'm really good at this?
Well, I still don't even think of it or look at it that way. I know I enjoy doing it, and for whoever is willing to watch me do it, I'm happy to do it. I don't ever think I'm good at this. I feel like I could go anywhere in the world and feel comfortable getting up on stage with people and playing make-believe. I feel like I could teach an improv class anywhere in the world. I feel like I could teach a sketch writing class anywhere in the world. But I'm never at a point where I'm like, I'm a master at it. I just feel like I'm someone who really likes it. I enjoy it. I'm very lucky because I found this niche for myself in this modern world where I get to do what I love doing, and it allows me a life where I can take care of my family. So I don't see it that way in terms of, I know who's good. I know, you know.
Who's good?
Well, I mean, you know, TJ, Dave, Kevin Dorf, Rachel Dratch, Tina, Amy. I mean, I've played amongst people where I'm like, these people are good. And I've been able to carve out a life where I can be in the environs with them.
You never thought you were on their level?
No. I mean, I feel like, look, you know, top 100 in the world, maybe. I don't know. But, no, those people are just, there's something little, there's different. They're just, I mean, look, I remember this short story. When I was a kid growing up in North Carolina, we used to play a lot of make-believe in the woods, and we had fake guns and run around and play like war and jumping around and diving. And a couple years ago, my friend John Glazer had the good fortune, he gave me a job on his show Delocated as his bodyguard, and I was in the woods with a fake gun running around playing make-believe. And I was like, I did it! Yeah. I had this moment. And so it was just been like, you know, through just, you know, friendships, the community of it, of my friends who threw down the rope, who got me jobs at places, people who taught me, that I've been able to kind of navigate these waters in the world of improv. I mean, what's great about improv is you need a lot of people to do it, you know. So it's, you know, if I can be of service in doing it. But, you know, and I'm not saying it in some kind of, like, you know, humble way. I'm saying, in like, I have a sense of where I am, and I have a sense, and I've played with people who they just do things on stage. They see things in a different way. You know, it's a simple thing, like seeing Kevin Dorf come down stairs and tie his robe around his waist, just something like that. I'm like, wow, that dude had enough wherewithal to know he was wearing a robe that was untied and tie it. Like when I would come and see you guys in Jazz Freddy, I mean, the things you guys would do, I was like, and we were the family at the time. And, you know, by your accounts and people's accounts, we had our place in the improv world. But Jazz Freddy, we would do our shows at I.O. We would do an 8 and a 10 o'clock show. And then we would run over to watch Jazz Freddy with you guys. And I was like, wow, these guys, you know, these guys are amazing, you know.
I don't think I ever saw the family because I was so jealous of your reputation. I mean, I was a really jealous guy.
But you also, I mean, you're doing amazing. I mean, you found, you know, you found your niche. You're teaching, you're performing, you came to New York. Your craft brought you to New York City.
It's a miracle.
You know?
Yep.
And, you know, that's the thing. It's just, You know, my doorman, whenever I'm in a suit and I walk out the door, my doorman always says to me, "All right, go out there and make a lot of money, Ali." I'm like, "George, I'm not going out to make money." I was like, "I have a show tonight." And he's like, "Yeah, yeah, make some money." And I said, I stopped because I can, you know, George and I have a relationship. I said, "George, if you pursue the goddess of craft, the goddess of money becomes jealous and pursues you." Huh? I say, "If you pursue the goddess of service, George, the goddess of money becomes jealous and tries to sneak in your pocket." He's like, "Oh, Like, he got that. He got that it's not, you can't go out just to make money. If you go out to just make money, you're not going to make money. You have to go out and say, "I'm going to be the best dishwasher I can be. I'm going to sweep these streets in a way like no one else has ever done."
So what are you the best at?
Well, I don't know if I'm the best at anything.
What are you aspiring to be the best at?
Well, I love teaching improv. I love teaching sketch writing. I love performing for whoever will watch me. I enjoy using my voice, you know, if someone needs me to record something. I enjoy playing make-believe in front of a camera. I enjoy people. I like talking to people. I enjoy architecture and design and building spaces. I enjoy putting systems in place to oversee those spaces. And again, you have to know, where can I fit in on this team?
So let me ask you this, and I know I'm not going to get it. I want an honest answer here, okay? Where would you like your legacy to be? You've done TV, you've done film, you've taught, you've started this theater, you've got many spaces here in New York, a couple bars. What do you want your legacy to be?
Well, I mean, when I think about that, the thing that gives me the most, I would say, pride is the people who have met here, gotten married because of this place, and had children if they wanted to. That will be a legacy that will stand the test of time, not these businesses. But in 100 years, if someone says, "My parents met at this theater called the People's Improv Theater, they were both on teams and they got married and then they had my grandfather," not, you know, that's really what matters more than anything, is that the love that is created because of these places. Not that I was, you know, I mean, I'm sure, I mean, at this point, we are losing a celebrity a day. You know, that's the rate they're dying at.
Because of drugs and alcohol?
Yeah, I'm just saying, we've created so much celebrity and fame, like every day it's going to be somebody someday. So whatever I could do in film, in television, in movies, or in whatever, it just won't, it's all just going to be content, digital content, that eventually, even that in 1,000 years won't stand the test of time, because who wants to keep that level of content? What will stand the test of time is people, that humans that were created, you know, and love that was created because you decided to open a theater and teach some improv and sketch classes. That's really, you know, if I have a legacy, it was that I, you know, did the best that I could do, and I, you know, oversaw spaces that made friendships and made, you know, people get together in some way. Because for me, it was done for me. I mean, I had dinner with a friend of mine from Carolina when I went back to North Carolina last week. I'd known him 25 years. When I had my 45th birthday party at Pioneers, I had 50-plus fraternity brothers fly in from around the world. So to me, I know what people here may not know is, like, what really is of value is not the spaces, the bricks and mortar. It's the friendships and relationships and the memories you make and the skill sets you acquire while you're at those places. Again, like the Pit, it's for someone who, I just want to try it once for fun, or it's for someone who's like, I want to do this a couple, 2-3 times a week, but I still have a regular job, I don't want to, you know, quit that. Or the person who's like, I want to get paid to write for film and television. To me, they're all equally as noble, they just demand a different level of work ethic and perseverance. Because that's the only thing that carries that person further, and that's really knowing that you really want to do it as opposed to the idea of it. Like, the idea of becoming a doctor I liked, the reality I didn't. But at one point, I played doctors on TVs, and I was like, I am playing a guy that I wouldn't have been able to be in real life at this age. It's a neurosurgeon. You know, so that was more fun for me. But that's a bit long-winded.
Ali Baranakian, thank you so much. Caretaker of the Pit Theater.
And there you have it. It's another episode of Improv Nerds in the Can. Can you believe it? What an episode this was. And I loved when Ali was talking about writing the original UCB4, those letters, and it was really nice, and I really appreciate his honesty. Also, I want to thank the People's Improv Theater and Ronnie Pascal and Ali Faranakian for inviting me out there and just treating me so well, because when you're on the road, it can be quite stressful, especially if you're me who doesn't like change. Also, I want to thank my producer here in Chicago, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes it sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning classes and workshops, The Artist Low Comedy, or to sign up for my Improv Nerd blog, which will make you a better improviser and a better person. Well, the better person thing is up to you. And sign up for the newsletter. Go to my new slick website. You got to check out my new website, jimmycorain.com. I'm really excited about it. jimmycorain.com. Same address, but a totally different new website. Also, as you know, we are taking over social media. We are trying to do it. So go to our Facebook fan page and like us. It really helps with my low self-esteem. And also follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd. And don't forget about our YouTube channel, where we have clips from our recorded shows. So you'll actually get to see the guests. You'll get to see the improv. It's great. So check that out. Also, we're on Feral Audio. Feral Audio is a podcast collective with people like Chelsea Peretti and Dan Harmon and Matt Dwyer and Steve Agee and Todd Barry, and the names go on and on and on. So just check out feralaudio.com, some of the most unique and innovative podcasts out there. Also, I want to thank our sponsors today. First, the Stumptown Improv Festival in Portland, Oregon. For more information, go to stumptownimprov.com, and the Institution Theater in Austin, Texas. And for their information, for their intensive, go to theinstitutiontheater.com. And of course, I want to thank you, because I couldn't do this without you. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat.
A cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I help people. She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My